Humbug. A modern adaptation of A Christmas Carol celebrates the downtown Eastside community in its 10th annual and final season. It's the perfect family holiday treat, filled with rock, blues, and Christmas carols. Plus, enjoy live music from a youth choir. Opens December 5th at SFU Woodwards, located at 149 West Hastings Street. For tickets and details, visit sfuwoodwards.ca.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thinkum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiam, Nisiaya, and the Scatulia, Talitin, Homasquim, Mustail.
Oh my gosh, Lauren, I have always wanted to be on the radio.
Christy, you know you can do that at CITR and Discorder, right?
What?
LGBTQ.
Dave Radio, Fridays at noon on CITR.
Wow, wow, Dave, you're so sway. Oh, Dave, I like your shave.
And we're the Daves. I'm David Bedanek.
I'm Dave Campbell.
I'm Dave Frank.
We're the Daves.
And you're listening to CITR FM 101.9.
CITR Radio.
And these are the Daves of our lives.
Let's go!
Friday, the 19th of June, 2020, and this is Dave Radio with Radio Dave on the radio. We're broadcasting live on CITR 101.9 FM and streaming on the World Wide Web at CITR.ca from an undisclosed location somewhere on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people. On the program today, Sunday is National Indigenous Peoples Day, and to celebrate the occasion, the NFP is releasing two locally made films for free streaming. We covered both of those films when they were released, and we're going to replay those interviews today. It's the Radio for Shut-Ins version of Vancouver's go-to hour for local independent theater, film, and music, and it starts right now. Don't touch that dial. Let's get right to it. To mark National Indigenous History Month, the National Film Board of Canada is making two locally Indigenous-helmed documentaries available online. These are both films we covered when they were originally released, and we're going to replay those interviews today. The first film is Marie Clement's musical documentary, The Road Forward. It features a score by Vancouver-based composer Wayne Lavallee and performances by many Indigenous artists. Wayne himself visited our studios in 2017. It was during the time of Canada 150, the sesquicentennial of Canadian Confederation, and our interview turned into a mini-summit between settler and Indigenous culture. We'll start with a song from the Judies for reasons which should become apparent.
Get out of bed and I'll stretch my
can. I'm looking good. I got some morning wood. My hair is perfect and it's perfectly understood that I'm walking, talking for time. Walking, talking.
So that's the track off the new CD, The Very Best of the Judies. And they, of course, were playing down at the Catalina Festival last weekend, a song called WTFM, Walkin' Talkin' Fertile Man. Speaking of which, we have Wayne Lavely in the studio. Hi,
yeah,
Wayne.
That's a great segue. Walkin' Talkin' Fertile Man. That sums me up.
Well, let's expand on that a little bit more.
Right.
You are described in your bio as an award-winning recording artist, singer, songwriter, and producer from the Métis Nation of Saint-Laurent, Manitoba.
Yeah, that's my community, but I was raised out here on the West Coast.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, so I never actually lived in Saint-Laurent. That's just where my people are from.
Mm-hmm.
And I moved to Winnipeg in the early 90s for about 6 months in the winter, and then I came right back to the West Coast again. It's like, no, I'm not having any of this.
No.
But the West Coast.
I'm a West Coast guy.
Yeah. I can deal with the rain and the clouds, but, if minus 40, it's just I don't know. But I love Winnipeg, though. The arts community is really, really cool.
It really is, isn't it?
Yeah.
My wife works in theater, and there's a lot of theater going on there and a lot of music. And it's very, very exciting place.
Yeah, for sure. And, I go to Winnipeg all the time, play music. So it's my biggest market just because of the Aboriginal. It's the capital of Aboriginal media in Canada as well.
Mm-hmm.
In Winipeg with APTN and everybody's Indigenous buzz surrounding the arts community there. So it's pretty happening.
Mm-hmm. And I was going to put this in my lead-in script and then I forgot it. But this year it's Canada 150 it's 150 years since the Confederation and the British North America Act of 1867. And I remember 1967 when it was the centennial and it was a big deal. It was a huge party and it was like history started in 1867 and we're celebrating. This year the story is a lot different. And a lot of people are saying, wait a minute,
there's a lot of history before 1867, and the Aboriginal voices are really being heard a lot.
Yeah, it is a different vibe.
Yeah.
It really is. In general, Canadians are educating themselves, or they're being educated mm-hmm. to what the true history is in Canada, and it's somewhat of a dark one. Can be a dark one, you know, and so a lot of this is a lot of new information for most people. You know, cultural genocide and oppression, right?
Yeah,
when you think of Canada, you don't think of those words,
right.
You know, and not at all, you know.
We're the nice ones.
Yeah, we are. We are the nice ones, and that's the image we try to put out there and portray, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Canada's had this deep, dark secret they've kind of tried to sweep under the rug for decades, and it's just being revealed, and it has to be. The story has to be told about residential school and cultural oppression and genocide in this country. And people are interested in hearing that story. I think, you know, younger Canadians are interested in hearing the history of Canada and how Aboriginal people, Indigenous people in this country have shaped that. And the stories are coming out. And people are really starting to, you know, think about Canada in a different way, you know, especially for me as an Aboriginal person, because I didn't grow up with my language or my culture that was taken from me, right?
Yeah.
And I was raised in foster homes, so it's always been a struggle to reclaim my identity as an Aboriginal, you know, person. And I've had to do that through the arts, through the music, through film, through dance, and tell my stories through that medium. So, you know, even when I look back, so my short lifetime, I look back and that's been a struggle for me. So we celebrate 150 years, right?
Yeah.
It's not really a long time, you know. A lot has happened before then, too, right? So, I mean, it's good. You know, I believe in the spirit of Canada and the spirit of 150, but it hasn't quite been realized, mm-hmm. right? So
yeah, and it's something that we all need to recognize and embrace, and not try to deny or feel shame or guilt over it, but just to say, what can we do to heal this, and how can we build on that to make this a better place?
Yeah, it's all about moving forward, you know, and not forgetting about the past, and educating Canadians about the past too, mm-hmm. right? And they accept it, or they don't, or they're not ready to accept it, right?
Yeah.
So it's moving forward, and
I know. I mean, my own history. I'm a fifth generation settler, and you know, my ancestors traveled across from, the original settler came to Nova Scotia in the 1830s, and then his son was moved to Ontario, and his son moved to Manitoba, and his moved to Saskatchewan, and then I was born in British Columbia, and it just recently I came to the realization that was all built on stolen land. It was all homestead.
Yeah.
You know, and that you know, I have my own pride and my own family and my own legacy in that, but also recognizing where that came from and who suffered because of it.
And a lot of the land is still unceded, right?
Yeah.
You know, and the treaties that, especially in BC, that the First Nations have been negotiating with the government have been, you know, been going on for years, over the last 50 years, 100 mm-hmm. years, you know, and these treaties have been exhausted and exhausted, right?
Yeah.
And that's, you know, for sure. I mean, like, I mean, a lot of people don't realize that we're still fighting the fight.
Yeah.
You know, we are. It's not about, okay, this happened in the past, now we're moving forward, yay, everything's good. This, you know, it's still a struggle, because it's, like you said, it's always been about the land and the resources, and that's still very valuable to the Canadian federal government, to the oil companies, major corporations. They still want it.
Yeah.
So they still conspire against Native people. So we're always standing on the front lines in support of, you know, the land, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you know, it's a funny thing, because, you know, like, when you think about our history, by the 1970s, Indian people in this country weren't even supposed to be here.
Yeah.
We were supposed to be killed off or assimilated, you know, and that was the mandate of the federal government and the residential schools, to kill us off, to take the land, stick us on reservations, and, you know,
and take away language and culture and family.
And through the children, right? Rip them from the communities and place them in the residential schools. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, and it's, you know, that part of history, Canadian history, was never, ever taught in schools.
No.
Ever. You know, you learned about the Métis people, you know, and, you know, the one, you know, kind of Indian, the Plains Indian, you know. So we were put in a box and stereotyped and, you know, and our culture was oppressed through Hollywood films. Yeah. And
anything that we did learn, it was all historical. You know, this is how it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
These are the people that used to be here.
Mm-hmm.
Not these are the people that are still here and they're still around you still, you know, they're still here.
Yeah. I have lots of hope and for the future, and I'm looking forward to the next 150 mm-hmm. years for sure, because there are a lot of great allies out there mm-hmm. who want to stand side by side with First Nations people and just, you know, to help promote culture and humanity and just, you know, and the arts, all through the arts, you know. The art is a very, very powerful tool.
Yeah.
It's the most powerful act of resistance to get your message out there.
Absolutely.
Whether it's a struggle or a celebration.
Well, let's talk about this film, The Road Forward.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what it is The Road Forward.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's an epic journey of a film. And it's not your typical feature-length documentary where it's a bunch of talking heads. It's told through art and music. It's like a series of these short music videos that are just – the cinematography is just spectacular. Mm-hmm. And the music production in the film is world-class. The director, Marie Clement, she wrote we call them story songs. They're a bunch of songs, and about our history, about Native nationalism, Native pride, about Aboriginal missing and murdered women, residential schools. So there are a bunch of these stories that were created into songs that tell the story through documentary.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes a very interesting and unique approach to watching a documentary. And there's so much history in this film. It's just
And this is a project that got its start during the Olympic Games in 2010, isn't that right?
Yeah, that's right. It was commissioned by the Olympics, and it debuted at the Aboriginal Pavilion. So
mm-hmm.
The Road Forward was actually a stage production. I wasn't involved in that production.
Oh.
I came on board after that. It got picked up by the Push Festival
mm-hmm.
as a workshop performance, and then it got picked up by Push the year after that, and it did three shows at the York Theatre on Commercial. So, and we had about 17 songs, and it was a full band.
Yeah.
I think there was like 12 of us on stage, and we had multimedia. We had this big scrim on stage. We actually had 3D images projected out as well. So at one point the audience would be given 3D glasses, right? And then all these West Coast images designs would be floating out at you, right?
Wow.
And I think it's the first time that's ever happened on the West Coast that a live band show incorporated like 3D images, right? So it was very multimedia. So, I mean, it was a rock show. I mean, the Road Forward was a band, and different guest compositors throughout the band wrote different songs, contributed songs, and we had all the images on the back. So there'd be a song called Good God about residential school, and in the back there'd be all these images of residential schools and all this stuff. And so that's kind of how we told the stories through song. And then the NFB picked it up. They produced the film, and they jumped on board and said, well, we totally be interested in making this into a film.
Yeah.
And so that was another journey. Just filming the songs and the music segments were so cool. But
Because you said they're all done like music videos, so there's some high production values going on.
Yeah. And I mean, all the music was produced and recorded at the warehouse at Brian Adams Studio
mm-hmm.
on this, you know, vintage Neve console. So it's got a really world class sound, and it's kind of like, have you ever seen that movie Across the Universe?
Yeah.
You know, the music segments in
mm-hmm.
there, that's kind of what it kind of, the opening segment of the film kind of reminds me of when you're looking at the cinematography and how the style of the story songs move through the piece.
Mm-hmm.
The movie really talks about Native nationalism and starts in the 1930s and goes to the present, because In the 1930s, we had there was an organization on the West Coast called the Native Brotherhood and the Native Sisters Sisterhood, and they were a union. And they basically started this union so they could promote and fight for the rights, fight just for the rights to hunt, to fish, take care of their families. And they did this through a Native publication called the Native Voice newspaper, which was distributed up all along the west coast of Vancouver, and with the help of Maisie Hurley and her law firm, were very strong allies with the Native Voice. And it was very, you know, such a period in time where, you know, I mean, I totally hold my hands up to these elders, our elders, and those people that fought for our rights back then, because, you know, they at that time in the 30s, Native people weren't even allowed to gather.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah, like, yeah. Just by having a meeting, they were taking their lives in their hands.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right? So to come out with the actual newspaper that was, you know, distributed up along the the West Coast.
Yeah, that was a real act of courage.
Yeah, and to see Native news stringers, you know, typing on typewriters and putting articles together, you know, dressed in suits with glasses, you know, and back in the 30s, it was kind of like not the image we usually see.
little hats with press in the brim. And
yeah. So, it's very kind of one guy said when we were at the Doxa Festival at industry panel, he said it was kind of jarring to see this, right? Because we're just not used to seeing Native people in that way, right? And we don't know that, you know, that history was like that, or Native people even did that kind of thing, right? So it's a fantastic film, and, you know, I encourage every Canadian to see this film if you want to really take in and be part of, you know, the true history of this country and, you know, what happened in the past and the present and how we're moving forward. Definitely check it out at the Vancouver International Film Festival.
Right. All right. So if you need to know more about it, you can go to the NFB website or the VIF, the Vancouver International Film Festival website. That'll tell you more about it too.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. All right. Wayne, thanks a lot for coming in.
Well, thanks, Dave Radio, for having us on the show. Very much appreciate it.
We have one of your songs from the film.
Yeah, this is called Indian Man, and this is like the opening sequence of the film. So if you dig this song, which you will, come see it in come see the visual version of it.
Yeah, yeah, I've seen the clip of it. It's pretty spectacular. Thanks a lot, Wayne.
Yeah, thank you. Got your brothers.
start. Spirits inside your bones move through your heart. You've got no saying from the start. Spirits inside your bones move through your heart. Now you're in him now. A crazy horse. You're in him now. You're a changing George. You're in him now. A crazy horse.
Are you energetic, mature, and committed to making a difference in the life of an Indigenous youth? Then you'd make a great mentor. Volunteer mentors at Vancouver's Urban Native Youth Association help youth recognize their many strengths and work towards future goals. To learn more about how you can become a mentor to a deserving young person, please visit unya.bc.ca/mentorship.
The other film we're talking about today is made by Burnaby-based Haida artist Christopher Auchter. It's called Now is the Time, and it's going to be available online starting on Sunday. This film was shot in White Rock and on Haida Gwaii, and it tells the story of the first new totem pole on Haida Gwaii in almost a century, carved and raised in 1969 by 22-year-old Haida carver Robert Davidson. Christopher Auchter was in our studio last September to tell us about the film. And sitting across from me right now is filmmaker Christopher Auchter. Hi, Christopher. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, no problem. It's a pleasure to be here. I was just thinking it's a Haida Raven landing in the student's nest here.
Yeah.
And I really love your intro song. It's amazing.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, yeah. Nothing like surf music to get things going.
That's right.
So let's talk about Now is the Time. As I mentioned, we had a lengthy discussion last week with Andrew Wilkinson, the director of the full feature-length documentary on Robert Davidson, Haida Modern, which had its world premiere. But you have also made a film about Robert Davidson, which centers on a specific event that happened 50 years ago, which was very significant not only to the Haida culture, but to art in general around the world. So tell us a little bit about that event.
Yeah, that was really was a big event and a point in our history that I didn't really know about coming into this, creating this film. Mm-hmm. It was, I had to do a lot of research and really immerse myself and hear different stories, hear from Robert, from Reg, from my uncle Michael, my grandma Barbara Wilson. Yeah. So it was a lot.
So you grew up on Haida Gwaii as
I
well?
I did. I grew up on the Skidigit end of Haida Gwaii. Went to school there, and then it seemed like I'd spend my summers up in Masset, commercial fishing with my grandfather, and just staying with my grandparents.
So, for those who haven't caught on, the event we're talking about is the first raising of a Haida totem pole on Haida Gwaii in, I think, over a century.
Yeah,
happened in 1969.
Yeah, and it. That was one of the amazing things I was learning as well throughout this, is that our art was that far, like it was that far gone.
Yeah.
And just like our culture had come on really hard times with the smallpox, the residential schools, and Robert told me it's like someone continually being punched.
Mm-hmm.
And
it was against the law to raise a totem pole.
Yeah, or have a potlatch.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, there was... All the laws, and you couldn't even someone that wasn't from, say, the Haida, like a white, like I hate saying that term, but if you weren't from the village, then you couldn't stay there at night. Like things like that. Like you had to be gone by sunset. Like it was such a segregated, and there's the Indian agent was there up in Massett. So it was all very, everything was watched upon.
Yeah.
And they were encouraged to get rid of their Haida art, the boxes that were painted, any carvings, are encouraged to either sell it or get rid of it. Yeah. So that's when Robert tells the story that he went searching door to door to see if he could find any examples because he wanted to learn the art, and he only found one Bentwood box that had a painting on it. One out of the whole village.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's staggering.
Yeah, it is.
It really is. And it's like an alien world now. Because of what happened in 69 and with the work of Robert and also Bill Reed before him, the resurgence of Haida art and Haida culture and how it's really exploded now. I mean, there's so much of it around and it's so widely celebrated.
Yeah, it is. And a lot of youth. And I think that's one of those things that day really helped is it helped inspire that next generation to do our arts. And that doesn't mean just carving. It might be weaving or doing the dances or learning the songs.
Yeah.
There's so many different parts that just wasn't – it's almost like it was sleeping.
Yeah.
And
now, Robert was like, I think, about 22 when he took on this project.
Yeah.
And I understand that he met a lot of resistance from some of the other elders and other people in his village.
Yeah, and it was because he told me it was because it was so painful. It was a painful thing, and like why are we gonna go there again? We're gonna just run into more pain, and just even like stories. Like my mom recently told me she wanted to learn the Haida language, and but her nani, her grandma wouldn't teach it to her, and that's just because they. You know,
their nani had been punished
schools.
For speaking it.
Yeah.
So there was pain right there, like physical pain associated with
it. Yeah, and they wanted the best for their children. And they thought, well, you learn English and you'll get ahead and stuff. So they didn't want it like things as simple as the language, but it's so important to culture.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about your personal journey with this film. How did you get spurred to make it in the first place?
Yeah, so I created a film just before this one with the National Film Board called The Mountain of Skana. It's an animated film. So I was in the office looking at the prospect of possibly creating another animation. And Shirley Veracruzzi, the executive producer at the National Film Board, said, well, hey, there's this project here. There's a film that we had created in 1970 called This Was the Time. And Barbara Wilson, who is now an elder in our community, was a key member of the team that and a reason for having the NFB up there to record this time in history with Robert carving the pole and the whole community raising it. But she got pushed out when it came time to editing it. So she didn't have any of the creative choices of what was going to be important.
Yeah.
And she never seen the film. She didn't even want a credit in the film.
Yeah.
But so 50 years later, 49 years later, she asked, can I see the film? And she saw it and she did not like it at all. And she asked, can something be done? And that's when they said, yes, something can be done. And the NFB, so graciously, they had a new edit and we opened it up even further and it became a whole new film.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's very exciting.
Yeah. And it was so exciting for me because, like I said, now I could learn this part of our history and then share it. And hopefully our youth will know it. And I've tried to create it so that it will engage them and they will pay attention so it doesn't just flow right through them that they hold on to.
Yeah, they can identify with it.
Yes.
And it's been a learning experience for you as well as a filmmaker. Because as you mentioned before, you mostly are considered an animator. Mm-hmm. So this is sort of a first attempt at kind of live action documentary film. How was that experience for you?
Yeah, well, I was excited about that, like because one, I don't have to work so hard to get a moving picture.
Right? Yeah.
With animation, you got to create the backgrounds, the character design, you got to animate them. And, And to be able to explore all that beautiful footage that they shot 50 years ago, the National Film Board and CBC that they shot as well, and pieced together a film telling the story. And it really became important that I wanted to try to place the audience there on that day, almost like they were witnesses to that. And it was a challenge that I really was excited about. So I was never scared about it. I just remember when I first got, okay, how am I going to tell the story? And you start your creative web, start trying to think about ways to tell the story a little bit differently. And how can I take my instincts for animation and marry them with a documentary? Yeah.
Great.
Both Now Is the Time and The Road Forward will be available for streaming free of charge worldwide in perpetuity at nfb.ca. This is from Colin Thomas's Fresh Sheet. It's titled Hallmark of What Exactly? Many creative types in Vancouver have been paying the rent, thanks in large part to work with the Hallmark Channel. Increasingly, the burning question is that a deal with the devil?
When Hallmark, which shoots endless Christmas movies in and around Vancouver, responded to Black Lives Matter by posting on Twitter, "We stand with you in the fight against racism and injustice," folks who work in film started calling them out as hypocrites. As Global News reports, local casting director Chris Wosnyczynski tweeted back, "Last time we worked with them, no interracial couples were allowed. Why?" Wosnyczynski also wanted to know why black actors were getting notes to be less hood. On Facebook, writer and director and friend of the show, Joel McCarthy, had already ripped a strip off the movie of the week industry. He did not name the Hallmark Channel specifically, but he did say that he'd had a meeting with a prominent Canadian movie of the week company. "They told me in order to make their buyers happy to make sure I don't have any interracial couples or openly gay characters in my scripts. I asked the executive to repeat herself because I was taken aback a bit." The executive responded, "We would like to be more progressive, but it's really our buyers we are worried about. Long story short, I'm not writing for a company that makes white supremacy films." In a town like Vancouver, where McCarthy estimates 30 to 40% of film industry work comes from companies like Hallmark, speaking up takes guts. Yogi Omar, who is the co-owner of Inspiration All Talent Agency, is willing to face the risks. He said that companies like Hallmark will cast people of color, but they just get pushed to the back. They're not visible. The Hollywood Reporter notes that there are black leads in some Hallmark movies. A statement from the company asserts that programs and their characters should reflect the wide diversity of our audience. And a company spokesperson insists that Crown Media Family Networks, Hallmark's parent company, continues to provide our production companies with written guidance on our hiring policies. According to Omar, they'll never say there's no interracial couples in their policies. They're just not going to buy it. "A lot of my clients don't want to work on TV movies or for Hallmark anymore. And he knows that speaking out could cost him. I might be losing my job, and Hallmark may never hire anybody from my agency ever again. At this point, I'm just done. I don't care about what's going to happen anymore. I believe I'm doing the right thing." Thanks to Colin Thomas for his continued great reporting. And please subscribe to Fresh Sheet by going to colinthomas.com.
According to the BC Centre for Disease Control, COVID-19 is transmitted through larger liquid droplets, like what's produced when you cough or sneeze, coming in contact with the eyes, nose, and/or throat. COVID-19 is not transmitted through airborne particles, or small particles floating in the air, or through skin contact. To avoid droplet transmission, wear a face mask if sick. Cover your coughs and sneezes in your elbow. Do not shake hands or high-five others. Wash your hands frequently and for 20 seconds. Do not share household items. Flush the toilet with the lid down. Practice general cleaning.
Western Canada's largest documentary film festival, DOCSA, will present the 19th annual festival streaming online June 18th to the 26th. Originally scheduled to take place in early May, DOCSA was one of the many cultural events interrupted by COVID-19. The online festival will feature over 64 films, shorts, and features from across Canada and around the world, streaming online as well as special live events. The festival kicks off with Wintopia, directed by Mira Burt-Wintonick. Wintopia traces the enigmatic footsteps of her father, Canadian documentary filmmaker Peter Wintonick. A special British Columbia spotlight will feature several Vancouver-based filmmakers, including Greg Compton's Eddie's Kingdom, the world premiere of Tony Massel's The End From Here, and a selection of short films, including Josephine Anderson's On Falling, which profiles three professional women mountain bikers. Films will be available to stream for the duration of the festival. They are geo-blocked to British Columbia, and virtual tickets will be limited. Select screenings will include pre-recorded filmmaker Q&As and extended discussions. Tickets and further information are available online at www.doxafestival.ca.
Yeah, check it out. I found that canned ham, and I put it in a pot of boiling water, and guess what I'm calling it?
Soup?
Hot ham water.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver, nourishing radio.
Mm. So watery. And yet there's a smack of ham to it.
Mm.
to make a stand. You gotta help your neighbors all across this land. And the frontline workers who fight to keep us safe, they are brave souls. By the courage I'm amazed. And doctors, keep your distance. Don't be a fool no more. Cops are standing on guard for you and I. So let's work together. Lift the spirit to the sky.
About you, see me smiling, but don't get comfortable. You, you, leave it alone.
never talk about you. I never talk about you.
And that's our show. Thanks for spending your lunch hour with us. Remember, if you want to keep in the know about theater happenings and not happenings in these wacky times, check out Theater Wire and Colin Thomas's Fresh Sheet. And if you missed any or all of today's show or want to relive glorious moments from the past, check out our podcast archive at citr.ca. You can also find us on player.fm. And remember to subscribe and leave a comment on Apple Podcasts. Stick around. Audrey's up next with Too Dreamy, followed by Beppe Crespin at 2, and our very own star on the BC Entertainment Walk of Fame, Nardwuar the Human Serviette, at 3:30. Dave Radio will return next week at the same time. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
To CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
This is Katie J. I play drums in Lié. You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.